Turning Tides is an Antics Entertainment affiliate. You can find us on social media at The Turning Tides Podcast on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube, and at Turning Tides Pod on Twitter. For more information, or if you're interested in sponsoring the podcast, please contact us at theturningtidespodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Warning, this episode of Turning Tides contains depictions of rape, suicide, murder, genocide, war, violence, racism, and abortion.
The invasion of Sicily, codenamed Operation Husky, was the first step in a plan to invade mainland Italy. There was much discussion between the Allies if it was even necessary. The American High Command wanted to launch an immediate naval invasion of mainland Europe and attack Germany at its strongest points. Winston Churchill and the British leaders felt that this strategy was unwise. They felt the edifice of fascism in Europe would crumble once airfields were acquired, which could strike German oil resources in the Balkans. Then Germany's allies would collapse. This rift between the Allies, as well as Operation Overlord, the Allied invasion of France, would severely hinder the liberation of Italy, as the fighting would quickly devolve into a slogging match of attrition. What made the coming invasion of Sicily possible was years of fighting in North and East Africa against Axis armies. General Alan Brooke said of these first years of fighting, quote, "In Africa, we learnt to crawl, to walk, and then to run," unquote. The Allies were pressured by the Soviet Union to open up a new front of war. Franklin Roosevelt was wary of his army's chances. He believed a concentrated air assault on Italy would be more effective than a land invasion. The Navy, meanwhile, was of the opposite opinion. Navy heads believed that the Allies had ought to focus their attention on Japan and the Pacific theater. With all these opinions in the mix, it's little wonder Italy became a nightmarish campaign for soldiers on the ground and hell for the civilian population. The first step to invading Italy was to throw German and Italian leadership off the Allies' scent. The British launched Operation Mincemeat, which was designed to make Axis planners believe a naval invasion of the Balkans was in fact the target. They dressed a cadaver in a Spanish army outfit and planted false documents on them. This feint largely worked, and Axis troops were dispatched from the Eastern Theater of War to the Balkans. German presence in Italy was increased as well. Italians remained nominally in control, but it was an open secret amongst German officers that a German coup could and would be effected in the country if Italian loyalties wavered. In either case, both sides viewed the Mediterranean theater as a backwater in comparison to the quote-unquote main war in the east and the invasion of France, which was set to take place in the west. Mussolini was faltering. He was now a complete shell of his former braggadocious self. He turned against his fellow Italians, seeking to place blame anywhere but on his own shoulders. He was also, somehow, more conceited than ever. When Naples was bombed incessantly by the Allied Air Force, he appeared to have relished the news of the city's destruction. Behind closed doors, he begged Hitler to consider a peace with the USSR, but Hitler would not budge. There was no strategy for the war the Axis powers were being forced to fight, only hold at all costs. Regardless, they believed the Allies would not bother with a massive invasion of Sicily. They were more concerned with possible landings elsewhere, specifically Scandinavia, the Balkans, or the Low Countries. they expected any Allied invasion of Italy to occur north of Rome. Therefore, they stationed the majority of their forces there. When the invasion began, German General Albert Kesselring would steal a page from the defensive playbook of Frederick the Great. He used a, quote, central reserve, unquote, of troops, which was based on what Andrew Sangster and Pier Paolo Battistelli say is, quote, the idea that a force surrounded by enemies might attack by surprise by relying on the swift use of inner lines of communications to redeploy forces, unquote. The Italian army was in a crippled state. There were over 200,000 men in Sardinia and Sicily, but these numbers meant little as the Germans had to constantly keep the Italian army supplied with equipment, naval armaments, and air power. The army was in a truly sorry state, and the units had no real fighting power anymore. On July 10, 1943, the first landings were met with prompt German counterattacks, which failed to break American, British, and Commonwealth units on their beachheads. The Italian army defending the island collapsed. In short order, Mussolini would be deposed and Pietro Badoglio would be named the new prime minister within weeks. The fact that the military took over, as opposed to one of the many exiled or retired liberals, speaks volumes about the king's attempt to save face for putting Mussolini in charge and letting him run rampant. He wanted to have his cake and eat it too. For a time, the Kingdom of Italy pitted one side against the other. Hitler demanded Mussolini be rescued, and in a daring parachute landing, German units extricated Mussolini from his imprisonment. They would place him at the head of a German-Italian satellite state remembered as the Republic of Sallo, or the Italian Social Republic. A handful of loyal fascist units were integrated into the German army, headed by Rodolfo Graziani, while the Germans were busy seizing all functions of the Italian state. Many thousands of Italian servicemen were sent to prison camps and worked to death. The Germans called this forcible integration of Italy Operation Alaric, an allusion to the German warrior of the same name who sacked Rome in 410 AD. The Allies, however, failed to capitalize on the anarchy which plagued Italy. The two armies were slowly moving their way through Sicily's rugged terrain. Overall Allied commander for Operation Husky, as well as subsequent operations throughout Italy, was Harold Alexander. British General Bernard Law Montgomery and American General George Patton led the troops on the ground. It was a massive undertaking, and to that point, the largest amphibious assault ever. However, there was little support equipment for men on the ground, as supplies were not adequately brought in for the invasion, nor the subsequent military occupation of the island. As the Allies rolled into town, the old mafioso bosses came out of hiding. Persecuted during Mussolini's reign, local mafioso across Sicily were now instrumental in securing the island's pacification in the weeks following fascist removal. Mafia influence reached new heights all across the island, and military administrators found it easier to work with these so-called men of honor than to work against them. The landing sites were initially meant to be Catania in the east and Palermo in the west, but plans were quickly altered. Andrew Sangster and Pier Paolo Battistelli say General Alexander was, quote, treating Patton's 7th Army as a shield to Montgomery's sword, unquote. American units would now land in Gela, supporting the British troops' main thrust at Syracuse. Patton was furious, as he and his troops were in a, quote-unquote, subservient role to the British. He endeavored to race Monty to a make-believe finish line. Poor weather and lack of surprise immediately hamstrung American efforts in this great race. Regardless, once ashore, Italian army units began surrendering to Americans en masse. This was the trend for the rest of the week. The American army captured more POWs in this single week of war than they did throughout the entirety of World War I. The most serious casualties amongst the Allies were tallied in the ranks of the paratroopers, whose landings were unmitigated disasters. The British employed hand gliders in one such attack, and the results were as one would imagine, especially since the troops using them were not taught the proper technique to fly them before handed one and essentially told to, "Have at it, gents," in the middle of a fucking war. One crew became so lost they ended up in Tunisia. In the worst case, 2,300 men were expecting to jump from 144 planes, and they were ultimately put under fire by their own naval support. 23 of the planes were destroyed and many men died, though the tally of casualties remains in dispute through today. Patton would describe this horrific event as, quote, "an unavoidable incident of combat," unquote. The Germans in Sicily remained determined and put up an intense resistance to Allied attacks. Monty, however, was confident. He was proclaiming that his men would be in Catania in a matter of days, and from there, they would easily capture Messina, then move across the straits into mainland Italy. Kesselring had just arrived in Sicily, and he endeavored to defend the island using the famous Mount Etna as his base of operations. This gave Patton the room he needed to move his armor at a rapid pace, capturing Palermo on July 21st. Patton turned his men quickly toward Messina as Monty struggled up deadly mountain terrain. Being pushed by the British to his front and the Americans on his flank, Kesselring realized Sicily could not be held. German engineers set about evacuating the tens of thousands of German soldiers still in Sicily. Allied codebreakers had caught wise to German designs, but Alexander did nothing to act on this intelligence. The last Axis soldier would successfully evacuate the island on August 17, 1943, ending the battle for Sicily, but beginning the battle for Italy. At the cost of about 25,000 casualties, the Allies captured over 120,000 men, most of them being Italian, while killing or maiming another 50,000 Axis troops. In the wake of the German evacuation, Allied forces moved on the ruined city of Messina. Left for them were countless booby traps, cunningly concocted by German engineers. Even corpses were rigged with explosives. Alexander was proving himself to be too hands-off, while Patton proved he was too hands-on. He famously struck two soldiers on two separate occasions. Both of the men in question were in a field hospital for non-visual ailments. After this second incident, when he pulled his gun on and threatened to shoot a trauma-ridden soldier, he was replaced. Patton would not be gone for long. He would soon find himself in France, where he led men to numerous victories in the fights to come. The new leader of American forces in Italy was General Mark Clark. British High Command had a low opinion of American fighting units, while American command believed the British were too uppity and prideful. The invasion of Italy began in order to secure the vital airfields throughout the country. Once occupied, they could be used against the Axis to strike at vital targets which supplied the enemy's war machine, namely Romanian oil fields in Ploiesti. It was hoped that, by opening this new front, German troops would be relocated to Italy from vital battlefields on the Eastern Front or from French garrisons. It was also hoped that, with Mussolini's ousting, the invasion would be easy. But with Operation Ulrich being a complete success, Italy's industrial heartland would remain in fascist hands until the end of the war. For the Axis, there were two schools of thought on how to defend Italy. Rommel believed the army should abandon Rome and pull back to the main supply bases in the northern half of the country, while Kesselring proposed a more static defense, fighting bitterly for each hill and ravine down the peninsula, while also relying on fast-moving panzer reserves to quickly support attacked positions. Ultimately, Hitler sided with Kesselring and made him overall commander in Italy, as Rommel became more and more ostracized. The Allies were expecting, and even counting on, Italian support, but the feeble king and the new prime minister, Badoglio, were still attempting to play both sides of the field. They had few loyal divisions, and those they had were undermanned and in no way able to combat the professional German military. Andrew Sangster and Pier Paolo Battistelli write that the American and British leaders were intending on attacking Italy with improvised forces, which, quote, led to the longest and bloodiest campaign of the war for the Allies, unquote. The plan was as follows. Monty would take his British and Commonwealth forces into southern Italy in a two-pronged attack, while a massive British-American army, led by General Clark, would land just south of Naples, around the beaches of Salerno. One British naval invasion would land in Reggio Calabria, around the same place where Garibaldi landed with his red shirts 80 years previous. This was called Operation Baytown. Another British attack would be launched across the Straits of Messina. This was called Operation Slapstick. The amphibious assault on Salerno was named Operation Avalanche. Baytown and Slapstick were both achieved with relative ease as few German soldiers were in the area to contest the Allied landings there. Very quickly, British and Commonwealth units overran the southern toe of Italy, capturing Brindisi, an important naval base, as well as the airfields at Foggia. This completed one of the main objectives of the campaign within a matter of days. Allied air could now target the lifeblood of the Axis war machine. This was easier said than done, as Allied air commands had differing strategies and coordinated very little with each other. The result was massive losses to Allied airmen and aircraft. Just on the American side, it's estimated over 95,000 aircraft were destroyed throughout the war. One of the main reasons resistance was proving so tough was that Allied command seemed to make no account of Italian weather or geography. Axis forces seemed to understand Italy better, and they did all they could to hinder the Allied advance, destroying bridges and infrastructure in the wake of their retreats. Baytown and Slapstick were total successes, but the story was completely different on the beaches of Salerno. Today, Salerno is a growing resort town, and its beaches seem pristine. On September 9, 1943, the sand was soaked in blood. Allied forces had less than half the landing craft they had used for their invasion of Sicily, as many of the vessels had been transferred to the Pacific or to Great Britain for the French invasion. General Clark would weaken his forces further by deciding to attack two separate locations, which were unsupported by each other. A 10-mile gap separated the northern and southern landing forces, and Kesselring, anticipating the amphibious assault, stationed his battle-hardened 16th Panzers in the area. Refusing to engage in a preliminary naval bombardment, Clark was under the mistaken belief that he had the element of surprise. Landing craft were greeted by light artillery, mortar, and aircraft fire. Many were sunk with the men still on board, and hundreds drowned. Those that did land found themselves in hell. German machine guns pounded away on Allied positions, who held a tenuous grip on the beachhead. A British colonel on the scene said, quote, "This reminds me of Gallipoli," unquote. For the next several days, German units hammered away at the Allied positions from the high ground surrounding the beach. Clark was ready to throw in the towel and call a withdrawal of his forces. But General Troy Middleton, commanding the 45th Division, refused his superior's orders. He said, quote, "Leave the water and the ammo on the beach. The 45th Division is here to stay," unquote. The German attack seemed about to break through and swamp the Allied position, but they had maneuvered themselves into the Allied gap. This created a kill zone for attacking Axis soldiers and their offensive ground to a halt. Allied air power and naval support were proving decisive factors in preventing and destroying many German counterattacks as well. Kesselring begged Hitler for permission to send in Northern Italian panzer divisions, but Hitler hesitated at the crucial moment. James Holland contends that if these northern divisions were deployed, quote, the beachhead would not have survived, unquote. As it stands, the slow-moving British army had finally threatened Kesselring's rear, prompting the German general to withdraw his forces in good order. It was an Allied victory, in a way. However, the Allies had lost over 14,000 men, while inflicting 3,000 casualties on the Germans. It is true, however, that the Allies had now gained a serious foothold in mainland Italy. The war would now devolve into a deadly stalemate for the armies, as well as the Italian people. During this time, the people of southern Italy largely welcomed the Allies as liberators, and there was mass rejoicing. In spite of this, there are four well-documented instances of Allied reprisals against Italian civilians. On July 14, 1943, an American officer opened fire on supposed looters after his men refused to fire on a crowd of civilians. Seven people were killed, amongst them an 11-year-old girl. The officer responsible was never charged, and the truth of the massacre was only revealed after the war. The next two occurred at Biscari on the same day. After encountering fierce resistance at the local airfield, around 37 Italian prisoners of war were lined up and shot by a sergeant who used a Thompson submachine gun. At the same airfield, a company commander ordered the execution of 11 POWs who had supposedly been harassing his men with sniper fire. Both officers would eventually be charged with murder and stripped of their ranks, but they would be allowed to rejoin as privates after there was an outcry from the alleged murderers' families. One of the two would be killed in fighting, while the other would never serve time for his crime and die in Oklahoma in 1974. The most far-reaching of all these atrocities was the Maracianate, or the Moroccan Deeds. This was the mass rape and murder of thousands of Italian people. It's estimated that as many as 60,000 rapes occurred. These rapes were perpetrated by Moroccan-French Gommier units. In many cases, they were perpetrated with the express consent of the unit's French officers. One officer of a Moroccan unit supposedly said this before battle, quote, "For 50 hours, you will be the absolute masters of what you will find beyond the enemy. Nobody will punish you for what you will do. Nobody will ask you about what you will get up to," unquote. Girls and boys, as young as 11, were gang-raped by groups of Moroccan soldiers while other Allied units looked on. Sexual violence was perpetrated on both sides of World War II. Recent scholarship has opened the book on some of the true horror which was inflicted on people in Italy and across the globe by Allied, Axis, and Soviet armies. American soldiers were no exception when it came to rape and sexual violence. J. Robert Lilly estimates that around 14,000 people were raped in England, France, and Germany by American GIs. Very few faced jail time, and people of color were charged and convicted much more often than their white counterparts. A 2015 Der Spiegel article claims the number of rapes committed by American soldiers could be as high as 190,000. In Italy, most women turn to sex work to feed themselves and their families. It's estimated by James Holland that at least 50% of the Italian female population became infected with some form of venereal disease throughout the war. One favorite motto of American GIs was, quote, "Copulation without conversation is not fraternization," unquote. The Allied soldiers committed many atrocities against civilians, as did their opposition. These soldiers rarely faced any repercussion for their heinous, power-hungry actions. Their feats of heroism are, of course, well recorded and should be remembered. Private Mikio Hashimoto was a Japanese-American who fought in the segregated 100th Infantry Battalion. Deployed to southern Italy, Hashimoto was confronted by 40 enemy soldiers attempting to envelop his platoon's left flank. Hashimoto held off the enemy with devastating machine gun fire before his weapon was struck by a bullet and made inoperable. He acquired a second machine gun only to have that weapon jam on him. Switching to a rifle, he charged the remaining Germans, killing one, wounding another, and capturing the last. In the valley below, the bodies of 40 Germans were lying dead. The next day, he was killed defending his position. For years, Hashimoto's Congressional Medal of Honor was denied to him because of his race. Vernon Baker was commanding a weapons platoon at the head of the segregated 370th Infantry Regiment in northern Italy toward the end of the war. His unit's objective was the foreboding Aginolfi Castle. Baker had a unit which was composed largely of green replacements. He was determined to ensure the survival of his men, so coming upon enemy machine gun emplacements, he took it upon himself to clear them out. He crawled on hands and knees until he came within close range of the machine gun bunker. Springing up, Baker killed 3 Germans before moving on to another bunker. He went on a one-man rampage against German positions. When it came time to evacuate the wounded, Baker exposed his body to fire so that they could be extricated. The next night, Baker voluntarily led a unit through a minefield in heavy enemy fire. Because Baker was a black man, he was not acknowledged at the time, but in 1996, this was corrected by President Clinton with a Congressional Medal of Honor. Chris Carr was leading Company L in Guignola, Italy, when his men became pinned down by intense machine gun fire. He charged the first machine gun and, in the surprise, captured 8 Germans. He charged a second emplacement, ducking and dodging enemy fire the whole way. Returning the fire, he felled 4 Germans, prompting the final soldier inside his machine gun emplacement to surrender. Coming upon another set of machine gun emplacements, Carr impetuously charged the positions. He killed 4 Germans in his solo attack, and his ferocity was such that the other team of German machine gunners surrendered outright rather than deal with Chris Carr. His Medal of Honor citation concludes, quote, "Sergeant Carr captured 5 enemy machine gun positions, killed 8 Germans, took 22 prisoners, cleared the ridge leading to his company's objective, and drove a deep wedge into the enemy line, making it possible for his battalion to occupy important commanding ground," unquote. As war raged, the Axis waited for the Allies behind the deadly defenses which were called the Winter Line, a series of pre-built fortifications designed to cripple any Allied advance. They were leaving Naples a massive wreck. The people of Naples had become fed up with the incessant bombings and raids by Allied airplanes. They rose against the German garrison and began the 4 Days of Naples, as well as the Italian partisan movement. A few hundred armed and determined locals showed that they were more than a match for thousands of German soldiers, who had only recently sent so many Italians to prison camps. The Germans continued their efforts in fighting determined rearguard actions and began their reprisals against Italian civilians. Around Lake Maggiore, 56 Jewish Italians were massacred, and around the Volturno River, around 22 people were executed by occupying German units. All the while, Andrew Sangster and Pier Paolo Battistelli say, quote, "The advance of the 5th and 8th armies seemed to be dictated by the pace of the German withdrawal," unquote. Allied units were first held up on the Volturno River line. The Germans then fell back to the Barbara line, then the formidable Bernhardt line. The Italian campaign was proving effective in countering the one great advantage the Allied armies had over their German counterparts. Italian geography successfully hindered the preponderance of Allied motor transport. Pack mules were reintroduced for supply purposes, and local Italian mountaineers were pressed into Allied service. As 1943 wound down, it was clear the fight in Italy was not going as planned. It was relegated strategically and tactically by Allied commanders, so their results were unsurprisingly lackluster. More resources were diverted away from Italy for the invasion of France. Now only 10 divisions controlled the southern half of Italy. The Axis was busy preparing for the next blow to fall. They had already evacuated Corsica and Sardinia, leaving the crucial islands in Allied hands. They would be used as jumping-off points for the invasion of southern France, Operation Dragoon. Attempting to break the stalemate in Italy, a major offensive began around Mignano on November 29th, and it would continue to gain ground throughout December. A few days before Christmas, it was clear the Allies had broken through, and Kesselring had ordered another general retreat to the defenses of the Gustav Line. This was by far the most formidable line of defenses yet, and the battles which would rage around Monte Cassino would become well known for their ferocity and violence. Some historians question the necessity of the continuation of the Italian campaign beyond this point. After all, the Allies had already controlled the Italian airfield in Foggia, while Rome possessed no strategic importance to the Allied war effort. They had completed their goals, so why continue? Regardless, it was deemed necessary to continue on to Rome in order to deal a deep emotional blow to the fascist cause. The Axis had come up with a solid defense, but an army which only defends is doomed to lose. As this war for hills and ravines played out, another war was occurring in the villages and cities of Italy. The partisan movement was just beginning to come into its own, and they would be largely responsible and should be largely credited with the successes the Allies experienced in Italy. Partisan cells had been growing amongst religiously and politically active Italians for some time, but only recently had they begun a targeted campaign of violence against their occupiers. The Italian partisans would wage a war of clandestine rebellion against the hated Tedeschi, or German. Reprisals against partisans and their families were the norm, and they experienced a love-hate relationship with the local civilians, who appreciated the partisans' fight for liberation, but were worried about what it would mean for their families, as there were mass reprisals by Germans whenever partisans attacked. Many early partisans were former military men, but many others were civilians who had been apolitical or even sympathetic to fascism prior to the war. Once war came and basic goods such as coffee, tobacco, and chocolate became scarce, the lie of fascism was exposed in the most ruthless way possible. Fascism extolled the virtues of strength and power, while exerting little strength and rotting the Italian state with its lust for power. By the end of the war, this ragtag group of freedom-loving Italian partisans would number over 200,000, while their casualties are estimated at over 80,000. At the center of this titanic struggle for Italy were the towns of Anzio and Cassino. They are remembered today as the epicenter of fighting, which lasted months. Both sides were deploying massive amounts of forces here. The Allies did this in the hopes of ending the war in Italy before the true battle against Germany began in France. The Axis were simply trying to hold on at all costs. At Cassino, a bloody stalemate was prophesied by Allied commanders, so they attempted to sweep around Axis positions by landing troops at Anzio. It was hoped this landing would end the stalemate on the front and capture many fleeing Axis troops in the Allied web. This landing was accelerated and pushed for by Winston Churchill, who always seemed to be backing some sort of amphibious invasion. On January 22, 1944, the Sixth Corps would land there and become subject to repeated German attacks. The German front remained fortified in the face of French, American, and British thrusts. Battle was waged along a precarious front for both Allied and Axis armies until May, when Allied attacks finally broke through the Gustave Line and nearly captured many Germans. American commanders would fail to ensnare German units because they were focused on taking the city of Rome. The effects of these two devastating battles had clearly taken their toll on Allied commanders in this theater. In both battles, Allied losses were immense, over 100,000 combined. Very few monuments were spared in the fighting around Monte Cassino. Famously, the Monte Cassino Monastery was reduced to rubble by repeated and deliberate Allied air bombardments. Unfortunately, the destruction of the medieval monastery and town aided German defenses. Time was on the Allied side, however, and their pounding attacks by a litany of units continued unabated. Advanced Allied units would enter the Eternal City on June 4, 1944. 2 days later, Allied landing craft were debouching in Normandy. In their capture of Rome, however, the Allies had let thousands of German soldiers escape and flee to the newly prepared defenses of the Gothic Line. This defensive line allowed the Germans to control all of northern Italy and use the industrial heartland to create weapons of war. Before departing from central Italy, Kesselring enacted his vengeance on the Italian population. In March, he had over 300 Jewish citizens and suspected partisans executed in the Arditine cave massacres. In August, alongside Italian collaborators, over 500 Italian civilians were killed in reprisal attacks. In September, over 1,000 were killed in the Marzabotto massacre, 200 of them being children. It was a sign of desperation on the part of the fascists and proof that the Italian partisan movement was working to deeply frustrate the designs of the Axis planners. Leon Weckstein describes several clandestine partisan operations in his book 200,000 Heroes. He says of one cell of resistance, quote, "grimy old rifles and double-edged switchblades had been the first weapons of choice for the rural group, since almost every partisan already possessed those useful instruments," unquote. It was a makeshift revolution, but one which was spurred on by the ineptitude of fascist rule, the violence meted out on dissidents, and the disappearance of many people from their homes. On top of partisan reprisal attacks by Axis soldiers, Jewish people in Italy were targeted for the final solution. Of the 7,000 sent away to German death camps, only 3 Jewish Italians returned to the country following the war. Besides Jewish Italians, Slovenes were targeted for internment by Italian and Croatian authorities. The Croatian fascist regime, or Ustasha, murdered hundreds of thousands of Serbians, while Italian authorities were responsible for the deportation of almost 12% of the entire population of Slovenia. One of many Italian concentration camps was the island prison of Rab, where thousands of Slavs, Jewish peoples, and dissidents were sent. Conditions were beyond dire, and of the 14,000 interred, over 3,000 would perish from disease or starvation. The island would be liberated by Yugoslavian partisans in 1943, and several former detainees would join the Yugoslav partisan forces. In total, it's estimated that over 800,000 Slavic people, many of them civilians, were executed by Axis forces throughout the war. Starting in 1943, ethnic Slovenes and other Slavic peoples began intentionally targeting ethnic Italians living amongst them. They are remembered as Foibe massacres, Foibe being the local word for a cavernous rock formation in which Italian and Slavic fascist collaborators had their bodies chucked unceremoniously. Perhaps 11,000 were killed. This massacre by Slavic partisans of fascists and ethnic Italians would continue into the post-war period. In 1947, over 350,000 Italians chose to leave Yugoslavia and Dalmatia and Istria. The Italian partisans, meanwhile, were waging a similar war of annihilation with those Italians still loyal to fascism and the German army. Prior to Rome's capture, they were instrumental in saving the lives of over 400,000 Europeans of various nationalities. Most of them were Jewish, but plenty of others were Slavic partisans, as well as Italian political dissidents. Thousands of others were not as fortunate. Ezio Malatesta was a partisan who was captured attempting to stop the German robbing of Roman art and administrative documents. He was a journalist, and he likely knew that upon retreating, the Germans destroyed the Neapolitan archive, and along with it, hundreds of years of southern Italian history. Brought before a kangaroo German military court, Malatesta admitted to his quote-unquote crime and remained defiant in the face of an antagonistic prosecutor, at one point spitting in his face. He was condemned to death, but not before writing to his mother, quote, "I never believed I could give you so much pain, but destiny wanted it to be this way, so I ask forgiveness from you and also my dear brothers, sisters, and friends," unquote. The next morning, he was brought in front of an all-Italian firing squad. He said, quote, "It pains me that it will be you Italians and not the Germans to shoot me. May God forgive you," unquote. Ettore Arena was given a similar sentence. He declared, quote, "I want to see those that kill me. Shoot me in the chest, not at my back. I am not the traitor. You are," unquote. Prior to their execution, partisans were usually tortured by their captors. Favorite practice of fascist guards would be to rip out the teeth and fingernails of their victims, then call in one of their close family members to beg for the victim's confession. Following the capture of Rome, the Italian front became a backwater for the war. Allied and Axis troops were moved out to reinforce the fronts on the west and the Pacific. The Allied forces still there were disparagingly referred to as D-Day Dodgers. It is due to this second-tier status that relatively few histories exist which detail the campaigns which liberated the Tuscan region and the Po Valley. It is true that, besides deeply destabilizing Mussolini's puppet regime, the campaign had no serious military objectives remaining. All that was left to do was push and hopefully end this violent war. On August 4th, South African and New Zealand troops entered the outskirts of Florence. What occurred next was largely due to Allied idleness. German snipers were devastating the ranks of the Italian partisans, and a small, violent civil war erupted all across the city. By the end of 1944, Allied troops could perceive that the war was nearing its conclusion, and many refused to die before it was over. The British Army was especially suffering from desertion and manpower shortages during this time. American numbers are tellingly omitted, but it's believed they were suffering severely from morale shocks and desertion as well. In northern Tuscany, it was reported that a wandering band of AWOL American soldiers regularly committed crimes with local gangs in the area. The situation for the Axis was much worse. Constantly harassed by partisan fighters, Allied air power, and bull-headed officers, desertions were occurring at a prodigious rate. Attacking along the coast and across the Apennine Mountains, a hodgepodge of Allied units made a final thrust at the Gothic line in an attempt to break into the Romagna Plain, where armored warfare could hopefully be fully utilized. Andrew Sangster and Pier Paolo Battistelli say this plan, Operation Olive, was a, quote, 1-2 punch rather than a focus on a single aim, unquote. Following the rapid deployment of Canadians to the Adriatic coast, Operation Olive struck German units retreating to the Po River defenses. It was a total success, and the element of surprise remained intact. Kesselring seriously considered calling for a withdrawal to Alpine Mountain positions. However, German resistance stiffened as reserves were able to respond rapidly to Allied attacks. As it would turn out, just south of Rimini, where in 1815 Murat made the first calls for a united Italian nation, Allied troops achieved a breakthrough on the Gothic line. Rimini would be in the hands of Greek and New Zealand forces by September 21st. However, the initial successes of Operation Olive had to contend with a flawed overall strategy. Focusing on two objectives meant both were close at hand, but by August, they were still not anywhere near Allied control. The naval harbor of Trieste was rapidly falling in importance with Hitler's decision to abandon the Balkans, following the Soviet Union's declaration of war on Bulgaria and the capitulation of Romania. Very rapidly, the Soviet army was storming the rest of the Balkans, and Tito's communist partisans were forging a nation from the ashes of the old in Yugoslavia. By October, Bologna still remained in Axis hands, while Allied manpower continued to be drained. Bracing themselves for the Allied attack, German engineers laid down layer after layer of defenses. They intended to make Allied soldiers fight for every inch of ground. Advancing at barely a mile a day, American units were being frustrated and whittled down by German defenders. As each futile day of fighting and dying passed, it became clear to Allied command that the fabled breakthrough of the Po River was not going to be occurring anytime soon. Throughout 1943 to 1945, the attitudes of the Italian people and the Italian partisan movement were changing. More and more, women were playing crucial roles in the liberation of their country. In countless instances, they played the role of messenger, driver, courtesan, medic, and frontline fighter. In the case of Gina Bolini, she began working with the partisans alongside her brother and her husband. Her husband was captured and executed by German authorities, while her brother was sent away to prison camp. She decided she could no longer be a simple gunrunner. She wanted to fight the Germans more overtly. In one encounter, she lost a leg to the Germans who had surrounded her unit, but she managed to live past the war and received Italy's gold medal for military valor. Carla Caponi lived a nomadic lifestyle around Rome. She was adept at killing Germans. In her first assignment, she walked up to a Nazi officer, shot him in the chest, stole his briefcase, and made a mad dash to the exit of the hotel in which he was residing. In time, she would become vice captain of the local rebel cell. She suffered greatly while living this desperate existence, at one point losing the use of one of her lungs, while also enduring numerous sexual affronts from her male counterparts. When asked later in life if she would do it all again, she responded, quote, "I would gladly kill again every German I've already killed," unquote. Maria Gaudino found her own way into the partisans. While out collecting water, a firefight erupted in her village between German occupiers and Italian partisans. She quickly came to a decision, picked up the rifle of a fallen partisan, and began laying a deadly fire on the Germans. She kept up her fire for 2 hours. Irma Bandieri was a courier for her local GAP, Armed Partisan Group, chapter. On August 7, 1944, she was returning home and was captured while carrying important partisan documents. They were in cipher, so only members of the resistance could read them. Her captors decided to put the screws to Irma, but she refused to crack in the face of mental abuse. Her guards began to torture her physically. Leon Weckstein writes, quote, "Her tormentors finally ran out of patience. Other robust, hard-headed men had bowed to the excruciating pain she had been enduring. Irma never gave in," unquote. She stared down her torturers with a defiant glare, so her torturers blinded her. The fascists threw her badly bruised, half-alive body into a pickup truck and arrived at Irma's parents' house. They shouted, quote, "Come on, give us some names. One name and you can go free. Your mother and father are here right behind this window and can take care of you," unquote. Irma refused to speak. She was riddled with machine gun bullets, her assassins cursing her as they sped away. The partisans were aiding the Allies all along their advance, and without the Italian partisan movement, the war in Italy may have been even more grinding and horrifying in terms of casualties suffered and material wasted. The main source of equipment for the partisans increasingly became the American OSS, or Office of Strategic Service. Much like its British counterpart, the American OSS was instrumental in equipping partisan movements in Europe and Southeast Asia during World War II. The main fighting contingent of the partisans were former Italian soldiers who had become disheartened and disillusioned by fascism and the cult of the Duce. To go against protocol, orders, and their nation's dictator took an immense amount of fearlessness and resolve. Besides assisting fellow partisans, Italian civilians were crucial in saving the lives of thousands of Allied airmen. Small villages became the epicenter of a large covert migration of people who otherwise would have been executed or sent to slave labor camps. In the town of Lucignano, for example, over 200 refugees on any given night were given lodging, food, and comfort. In total, 10,000 Allied servicemen of various branches and nationalities were saved from a cruel fate as an Axis POW. Many thousands more were safely extricated to Switzerland. Leon Weckstein concludes, quote, "Not one of these escapes would have been conceived without the self-sacrifice and cooperation of many rural Italians, peasants, shepherds, and old women, tough as the soil they tended," unquote. On March 8, 1945, Kesselring was summoned in front of Hitler and granted command of all German forces fighting in the West against the Allies. The Southern Front was now in the hands of Heinrich von Weitinghoff. At this point, German manpower and industrial capacity was practically non-existent. The Allies, meanwhile, had begun introducing Italian units into their armies, who were armed and equipped by Pietro Badoglio's government. He was still hoping for a, quote, good peace, unquote. Americans were hoping, meanwhile, to destroy German forces before any more nightmare scenarios could play themselves out. American command had been dreading the possibility that German forces could retreat to the Alps and make a stand there for years, using the terrain as a buoy. The British were less concerned with the German capacity to continue the fight. They were more worried about halting the Soviet army and Yugoslavian partisans and their advances into Italy's northeastern frontier. Unable to reach a compromise, Operation Grapeshot would be another 1-2 punch, aimed at crippling German resistance in northern Italy for good. All over Europe, the once formidable Wehrmacht was falling back. It was now an ideological race to the finish. Democracies on one side and communism on the other. The Germans were being completely overwhelmed and Hitler became increasingly isolated in Berlin. His empire was collapsing. Mussolini was attempting to get out of Dodge as fast as he could. All his former confidants and friends had abandoned him. All that was left was a hardcore group of supporters and his mistress. The Republic of Salo was collapsing, so Mussolini disguised himself as a German officer and attempted to flee the country. To where? Who can say? In the wake of Operation Grapeshot, Italian partisans all across northern Italy called for a general uprising, and the entire north of the country was in a state of civil war and violence. Mussolini was captured on April 28, 1945, by Italian partisans, after he attempted to leave the country with German soldiers. The partisan leader, Walter Arduzio, was given his orders. He carried out the execution sentence on Mussolini and his mistress with a French submachine gun, which had been looted from an Italian fascist the previous day. The next day, the bodies of the Duce, his mistress, and other leading fascists were dumped in Milan's Piazza Loreto. Days before, fascists had executed supposed partisans here and let their bodies rot in the sun. Upon seeing the quote-unquote immortal Duce's body, a crowd began to form. Enraged by years of bombings, murder, lootings, rape, and prison, the crowd fell into an absolute frenzy. One woman pulled out her pistol and shot Mussolini several times in the head, and then, for good measure, urinated on his face. A man came by with a mouse and attempted to shove the poor animal into Mussolini's gaping, dead mouth. He was shouting, quote, "Make a speech now! Make a speech now!" unquote. The bodies of the Duce and his mistress were strung up by their heels in order to keep the mob from further defiling them. The next day, German forces still fighting in Italy formally surrendered to the Allies. The war had come to an end for the Italian people, and already new forces were promising to change the lives of Italians for the quote-unquote better. In total, over 500,000 Italians would lose their lives in World War II, a good percentage of them being civilians. The loss in art, buildings, churches, businesses, and most importantly, history, is incalculable. Kesselring, who ordered the deaths of thousands of Italians, was convicted of war crimes, alongside several other higher-up German leaders in Italy. However, his conviction caused outrage in Great Britain, where his former foe had nothing but nice things to say about him. General Alexander wrote of Kesselring, quote, "He fought us hard but clean," unquote. Well, Lieutenant General Oliver Lessey said he was, quote, "very sad," unquote, that the death penalty would be meted out against an, quote, "extremely gallant soldier," unquote. The Italian government, meanwhile, refused to carry out the death sentence, as the new Italian state believed capital punishment was morally wrong and forbade it in their new constitution. He would be transferred to West Germany, where he worked with the U.S. Army Historical Division, writing many books on the campaigns in Italy and North Africa. In October 1952, he was released after he was diagnosed with cancer, and he died in 1960. The story of Kesselring was nothing new. Dozens of war criminals and fascist murderers would walk free in the hopes that their political clout might give Western democracies the edge against Soviet communism. The Soviets likewise participated in this recruitment of former fascists. The world had devolved into two camps, and the Allies were eager for the new Italian state to be a part of their team. Italy would not be militarily occupied by the Allies following World War II. Instead, the country was stripped of its African colonies, forced to pay Ethiopia a modicum of reparations, and they had to yield Fiume, Dalmatia, and Istria to Yugoslavia, while Trieste became a free city under the newly founded United Nations. Otherwise, Italy retained much of the land it held prior to the war. The country kept its northern frontier and all the German speakers who lived there, and they were even allowed to keep the Val d'Aosta Valley, which Charles de Gaulle attempted to annex to France. Once more, Italy was split down the middle, not just geographically, but politically and morally as well. The official Kingdom of Italy had spent the years between 1943 and 1945 as a loosely defined entity. Churchill did not trust the Italians as far as he could throw them and allowed them the status of co-belligerent only in World War II. This did not stop the king and Badoglio from asserting their right to quote-unquote rule Italy. They did this poorly, and in reality, the Allies were the ones truly in charge. In Sicily, a separatist movement was gaining serious headway, and plans were made to fund a private army to, quote, keep out Italians, unquote. Additionally, schemes were hatched to turn the island into America's 49th state. But this would not do, and after some grumbling, Sicily was brought into the Italian fold once more. Amongst the new and old political parties, there were several fundamental changes. The Christian Democrats were back with a vengeance, and they were headed by Alcide de Gasperi, who spent the fascist years as a clerk in Vatican City. Next were the Communists under Palmiro Togliatti. Unlike most European states, Italian Communists proved more willing to accept liberal reform, and Togliatti may have been largely responsible for that. He was in Moscow during the war, trying to play the game Don't Wake Stalin. He succeeded in evading Stalin's ire, and his tact and diplomacy found his Communist Party a part of the first few crucial government coalitions. The Socialists were arguably more radical than the Communists, and they proved impossible to work with for now. And last but not least was the Party of Action. This was a Republican, anti-clerical, and left-wing political movement, which heavily identified itself with the partisan movement. It was unclear who the Italian people would come to favor. What was clear was that the divide between North and South was now even more pronounced. The worst parts of fascism did not fully reach southern Italy. In this way, many southern Italians do not hold the same contempt for fascists as those who lived with constant reprisal killings and civil war. This would shape the coming dichotomy of the new Italy. Following the end of the fighting, Togliatti declared a general amnesty for all the killing and fighting which had occurred. Many still openly supported fascism. On average, neo-fascist parties won anywhere from 7 to 10% of the national vote, and their party would wind up becoming kingmakers in several crucial right-wing governments to come. In 1946, the Fascist Democratic Party gained notoriety after several of its supporters supposedly kidnapped the remains of Mussolini. Alongside this far-right enclave in post-war Italy was the Average Man Front, a political party which refuted many of the, quote, ideals of the resistance, unquote, by asserting the, quote, average man, unquote, just wanted to be left alone. This party would gain over 1 million votes. King Victor Emmanuel III continued to hang around. He tried to act like nothing had happened, like he wasn't largely responsible for the past 20 years of moral bankruptcy. Dennis Mack Smith contends, quote, had he abdicated in 1943, as did Carlo Alberto at another moment of defeat in 1849, the monarchy might have survived, unquote. As it stood, the question of continuing or discontinuing the Italian monarchy rested on the Italian people to decide in the form of a national referendum. UK listeners, I'm sending you hints. Victor Emmanuel realized he was about as popular as a soggy piece of toast, so he abdicated in favor of his much more charismatic and popular son, Umberto II. Upon his ascent, he blamed the events of 1922 on the Italian people. Smart move. As a result, Umberto would be the sovereign of Italy for a total of 34 days. The vote was still very close. 12.7 million Italians voted to abolish the monarchy and make Italy into a republic, while 10.7 million wanted to keep the institution. Most in favor resided in the south, with Naples overwhelmingly voting to maintain the monarchy. Before a constituent assembly could be called, elections were held to assess the will of the Italian people. In June 1946, the results showed that all three anti-fascist parties, the Socialists, Communists, and Christian Democrats, had clear support amongst the electorate. Out of these three parties, the Christian Democrats were by far the most popular, receiving enough broad support to claim over 200 seats in the new parliament. Together, Socialists and Communist parties controlled about the same number of seats, but there was little chance they would work together. The success of the Christian Democrats is largely due to the vote of women. They were allowed to vote for the first time, and 60% of them voted Christian Democrat. This was largely due to an effective propaganda campaign by the party and the Catholic Church. The rest of the seats of parliament were filled by old-school liberals, neo-fascists, and Party of Action members. Unfortunately, this last resistance-based movement garnered only 1% of the vote, as their messaging was unclear, muddled, and doctrinaire. Communists went out of their way to work with the first Christian Democratic government and were rewarded. The Constituent Assembly was presided over by the communist Togliatti. This alliance would prove to be short-lived, as the communists would be expelled in 1947. But for now, the country came together for one of the few times in its history to vote nearly unanimously on a new Italian constitution. The left won in regards to several crucial areas. The new constitution guaranteed a job for all its citizens, a living wage, free education, national health care, and the right of employees to share in the profits of management. The Christian Democrats did not mind giving in to these demands, so long as they were able to maintain Mussolini's concordance with the Vatican, which made Roman Catholicism the state religion of Italy. Additionally, the Christian Democrats wished to keep fascist-era policy, which prohibited divorce and maintained certain clerical privileges. The maintenance of Roman Catholicism as the state religion proved the most enduring part of the Constitution, as Italian unemployment numbers attest to the lack of follow-through on these other social questions. One of the only groups which voiced its opposition to the continuance of the Concordat were the small party of Social Democrats under Giuseppe Saragat. The new constitution changed many things about Italian political life. The king was no longer head of state. Instead, a president was chosen after a joint session of the Senate and the Chamber of Deputies. The president had relatively little power, but several Italian presidents would endeavor to change this fact. The republic was also designed to be democratic and decentralized, although true decentralization would not occur for another 20 years. Parliament would be elected through proportional representation. Many of the larger parties wished this wasn't the case, but it gave a much more diverse field of opinion to voters. This was a double-edged sword, as over 100 different political parties were on the ballot for the coming election. Crucially, the courts would remain largely intact and be filled with Mussolini appointees for decades to come. The disparities in the new constitution were clear to all, but it was the antithesis of fascism, and that at least was good enough for now. Christopher Duggan says the new constitution, quote, underlined the gap between the mass of the population and the elites, and thereby the limits of the latter's moral authority in the country, unquote. The new constitution was ratified in January 1948 at a crucial time for Europe. In Czechoslovakia, a coup funded by the Soviets succeeded in capturing the functions of government and turning the state into a so-called workers' democracy. This was one of the main reasons the communists were ejected from Italy's first post-war coalition. This coup also deeply hurt the Communist Party in the elections and greatly bolstered support for the Christian Democrats. They won with an impressive 48% of the vote, garnering them 53% of the seats in Parliament. Dennis Mack Smith contends that this victory, quote, represents the high watermark of Christian democratic fortunes, unquote. Italian society was now split between two great halves of thought. The left, which was never powerful enough nor willing to compromise in order to form a coherent opposition, and the Christian Democrats of the right, who used church funding and the remnants of the fascist state to control political dissent and rail against communism. Primo Mazzalori wrote in 1949, quote, "Everything is being rebuilt, but we are not. We continue to grow in number and speak the same language as the men of our Risorgimento. It is hard to say that we have returned to being Italians. The resistance is still going on, but in the name of party, pitted against the fatherland, perpetuating and aggravating the divide. I see collective suffering and collective poverty that could soon become collective ruin. But I do not see a collective fatherland. I see fascists and partisans, not brothers and Italians." Unquote. Italian courts, stocked with judges who were placed there by Mussolini, disregarded vast swathes of the new constitution, while repressive measures were introduced to curtail labor unrest among southern workers. In 1949, three people were shot dead by state authorities after protesting for their rights in Calabria. These same courts let numerous fascists walk after several were brought up on charges related to grievous torture. Guido Leto, head of Mussolini's secret police, was freed after he claimed he was, quote, "only following orders," unquote. In another instance, a fascist captain who ordered his troops to tie a female partisan to a tree and then ordered his troops to take turns raping her was not deemed to have tortured the woman, but to have committed, quote, "the maximum offense to the honor and modesty," unquote, of the woman. Meanwhile, former partisans had their deeds during the war called into question. Some were branded as common criminals instead of freedom fighters, and thus not granted the general immunity other combatants received. In 1954, the Supreme Court of Italy reached a new low. They decreed that Mussolini's Republic of Salo was a, quote, "legitimate government," unquote. This meant that those who had fought under Mussolini's puppet regime had not committed a crime, but the irregulars and partisans who attempted to cast off this yoke had. In the public sphere, the first of many books detailing, quote, "how great Mussolini in life under fascism were," unquote, came out. Il Buonuomo Mussolini asked, quote, "what had Mussolini done that was so wrong?" The writer, Indro Montanelli, claimed Mussolini's regime was characterized by, quote, "mildness," unquote. Despite the absurdity of this claim and many claims made by fascists about Mussolini and his regime, Montanelli's book became a bestseller, and other, quote-unquote, revisionist works mirroring it were released in turn. As late as 1960, it was calculated that 62 of the country's 64 prefects were fascist appointees, while the same was true for 135 police chiefs and 139 of their deputies. A prime example is Gaetano Azzariti. He was once head of the fascist race tribunals, but in 1957, he would become the head of the Constitutional Court. That same year, a solemn procession was being held for a man who had long since departed this world. Supposedly, Mussolini's remains had been kept safe in a monastery in Milan all this time. Requests by his family up until this point largely fell on deaf ears. However, the new prime minister, Adon Isoli, had discreetly changed the government's mind. He was likewise from the small town of Predappio, where Mussolini first got his start in politics. Additionally, the Christian Democrats largely relied on neo-fascist votes to maintain a majority in parliament. A member of this same parliament was Mussolini's executioner, as well as one of Mussolini's die-hard admirers. Zoli threw the neo-fascist party a bone and allowed for the former Duce's remains to be buried in his hometown 12 years after the fact. Fascists stood with their right arms raised as the procession buried the bones of their Duce. Today, the site is a pilgrimage spot for thousands of fascists every year. Only recently was the town forced to stop its pushing of fascist memorabilia. With the burial of the Duce of all Italians, Italy believed it could bury the sins and the ghosts of its past. But Mussolini's ideas and disciples would hang around like a bad fart. His reign of more than two decades forever tainted Italian political life. People would attempt to emulate him or be his antithesis. His specter would go on haunting the Italian people up until the present day. Giorgia Meloni, Italy's first female prime minister, began her early career in politics as a part of the youth front of the Italian Social Movement, which was a neo-fascist party, which dissolved itself in 1995. Following this, she associated herself with the post-fascist political party, the National Alliance. Before we finish up today, I would like to call attention to Dan Carlin and his newest Hardcore History Addendum episode. For the most part, I believe Dan Carlin is spot on in many of his criticisms of authoritarian regimes, and his remarks on Israel are completely correct. That being said, right before his interview with Dan Stone begins, Dan Carlin calls upon horseshoe theory to advocate against extremist governments. For those unaware, horseshoe theory is an idea, unsurprisingly advocated by centrists, which purports that the closer you get to each extreme of the political spectrum, the more alike those governments will be. I believe this theory is completely incorrect. In every circumstance throughout modern history, the center has allied itself with the right to prevent the left from ascending into power. In places where left-wing governments take hold, they are vilified and met by United States-funded terrorism. Additionally, people who support this idea clearly do not understand African, Southeast Asian, Middle Eastern, and Latin American history. The Arbenz government of Nicaragua, as well as the Allende government of Chile, were both democratically elected left-wing so-called revolutionary governments. In both cases, the center aligned itself with the right to destroy both governments, leading to the deaths of thousands of innocent people and the rise of notorious dictatorships. The list doesn't stop there, but these two examples show how truly flawed horseshoe theory is. I agree with Dan that history should act as a blueprint for future generations, in the way that we should learn from past mistakes. But the history from which we're learning these lessons needs to be all-encompassing, not Eurocentric. On top of this, I think just analyzing historical facts isn't enough. History should be analyzed with an empathetic lens in order to understand the faults of our past, learn from them, and apply the lessons we learn to modern life and politics. Right-wing governments fail. Anyone who attempts to bring society backward or keep it stagnant is actively contributing to the fall of that society. They may not intend this. They may even think that turning back the clock will make their country great again. But history shows that civilizations which decry and suppress progress are doomed to relegation and dictatorial rule in the end. America has not seriously changed since the end of World War II. And the honest truth is that centrists and liberals who betray progress are directly responsible for the rise of right-wing extremism today. They have essentially co-signed extremist behavior since the dawn of republics and democratic rule. Italy is another prime example of this. The centrists gave it all up to Mussolini. In the next episode, you'll see centrist Italian governments conspire with far-right terrorists to intentionally destabilize the Italian state through deadly terrorist attacks. The left would respond in kind, but would never have the backing of the Italian government. Germany mirrored this as well. Hitler openly worked within the bounds of German democracy, and then he upended and destroyed German democracy. Even if there are people who masquerade as leftists and step into power and then abuse it, the fascist and dictatorial governments who have plagued us are in no way comparable when it comes to human life and liberties lost. I believe a much more realistic way to look at history and politics, and a way which will actually bring about systemic change, is to view history and politics like a fishhook. In all modern political and historical cases, the center has allied with the extreme right to prevent even the smallest amount of leftist advancement and public progress. Currently, centrist Joe Biden is blatantly funding a genocide against Palestinian people because of our government's corrupt nature and inability to decry oppressive regimes. This is not ancient history. This is happening today, and it is a very real and very disturbing example of how centrists co-sign terrorism for the sake of quote-unquote keeping the peace with far-right states. There is only one way to move forward in society and in politics. Either we choose self-awareness and growth, both as individuals and as a people, through progress, freedom, and enlightenment, or we will all fall together. At that point, all the theory, speculation, and grandstanding in the world won't save us from the flood. The only thing that would save us is concrete, decisive action and the banding together against oppressive governments and systems worldwide. In the final episode of this series, I will be covering the post-war years in Italy, as well as the rise of modern-day fascism in Italy. The old problems would remain apparent and in many cases become exacerbated, while modern issues would challenge the country in ways never expected. We will discuss how corruption, mafia violence, political terrorism, and an unfeeling government shaped present-day Italy. The Cold War would lay bare the fault lines of Italian thinking and begin several economic miracles for Italy. To hear if Italy could truly shake off the faults of yesterday, you'll have to stick around for the next episode of Turning Tides. Thank you so much for listening. And please, remember to have empathy for your fellow people.
If you like what you heard today, you can support us by donating on PayPal at Turning Tides Podcast 1. Thanks for the support and thank you for listening.
If you like what you've heard, we'd really appreciate it if you take the time to rate and review Turning Tides on whatever platform you use to listen and share the show on social media. It really helps us to bring the show to more listeners. Thank you guys so much. Thank you to everyone for listening. We'd also like to say thank you to Movo Photo. We use their sound equipment for this podcast as well as all of our other projects at Antics Entertainment. They make great equipment at great prices, and we really appreciate that they make content creating so accessible for indie creators like us. Check them out on social media at Movo Photo, MOVOPHOTO. Thank you again.